So thank you all for coming out this evening. It's a beautiful evening. We could all be at the beach, you know. But here we are. Thank you. So tonight I want to talk about the question, what did Bodhidharma do? And, you know, we know that Bodhidharma sat. And we know that he sat facing the wall. And we know that because we do that too, as Kokyo has pointed out. And so we understand Bodhidharma to be a very deep practitioner of Zen. Bodhidharma is the first Zen ancestor. He brought Zen, as most of you know, from India to China. And somewhere along the way in his practice, we know that a person named Weka showed up. And Weka, or Taisho Eka in Japanese, in our lineage, that's how he's shown. Weka became ultimately the second Zen ancestor. He received the robes and bowls from Bodhidharma. But at this point in time, he was a person who is described in the story as suffering from mental anguish. We don't really know what that means, but you know, I assume it means you know, emotional pain. And he had been a seeker for many years, apparently, before he heard about Bodhidharma. He had been studying around China and with various teachers, trying to find relief. And he heard about Bodhidharma and sought him out and found him. And asked Bodhidharma, this is the famous story, asked Bodhidharma if he could study with him, if Bodhidharma would be his teacher. And we know from the story that Bodhidharma said no. And Weka, we know, stood outside Bodhidharma's hut for a while. We don't know how long. I've seen, you know, pictures in series, drawings, people's imagination, you know, of Weka standing outside the hut. And there's always snow. And the snow is rising around him. Sometimes in the last picture, there appears a little flower out from the snow. So it was quite a while that he stood out there. I mean, we can be pretty sure if these pictures are accurate, that Weka stood out there for quite some time. And finally, he decided that he needed to prove his devotion to Bodhidharma. He needed to prove his dedication to Bodhidharma. So the famous story, you know, he cut off his arm. And he went to Bodhidharma and presented his gift. And Bodhidharma, you know, whether the story is true or not, I really, you know, we will never know. Did he cut off his arm? Did he not? For me, it doesn't matter. Whatever he did impressed Bodhidharma, and that's good enough for me. So Bodhidharma invited him to practice with him. So we see now two things that Bodhidharma did. Bodhidharma sat. He practiced. And we see him also testing Weka in this story, refusing him at first pass. And this is something that that we hear a lot about in Zen, this testing. And it seems like it's probably important for a teacher to cause the student to ask the deep questions about how sincere and serious they are about practice and whether they really want to study. How motivated are they? I think that teachers often don't, you know, accept the first request, but my teachers in the past have caused me to go back and think about what it means and what commitment is involved and really, you know, is that really what I want? There's something, you know, that feels good about being asked. So I'm sure it's not always easy to say, well, you know, go ponder it. But it seems to me that for the most part, that's what happens. And here in our earliest literature, we have an example of this, albeit an extreme example. So now Bodhidharma accepts Weka as his student, and Weka begins to practice with him. And we can fill in that, you know, during this period of time, Bodhidharma taught Weka. Weka received teachings from him. And I can imagine that Bodhidharma probably taught Weka how to be stable in his body, how to stay in his body, while the volcano in his mind was doing what it did. And I can imagine that because my teachers have done that for me, have taught that to me. And I can imagine that over the period of time that Bodhidharma was Weka's teacher, that many, many teachings were transmitted between the two of them and from Bodhidharma to Weka. But you know, what we have is a famous story about an exchange between the two men. I suppose that this exchange is a culmination of probably a series of similar exchanges that the two had, in which you know, Bodhidharma would, you know, says, "Bring me your mind," and Weka brings him his latest version. Well, I'm sad, you know, it's sad now, or I feel joy now. You know, Weka brought Bodhidharma various versions of mind, and Bodhidharma responded. But in this instance, in the story that got recorded, as many of you know, Weka said to Bodhidharma, "I want you to pacify my mind." And Bodhidharma says, "Bring me your mind, and I will pacify it." And Weka says, "I can't find my mind, so I can't bring it to you." And Bodhidharma said, "I've pacified it." So what happened there? What did Bodhidharma do? I think that, you know, as I said, I would imagine that this dialogue was the culmination of lots of exchanges, similar exchanges. And here, you know, basically, Bodhidharma, it seems to me over the years of them practicing together that Bodhidharma witnessed Weka's suffering, completely witnessed his suffering, and also witnessed his strength, witnessed his capacity, his dedication, his commitment. And over the course of those years of exchange between them and of teaching and learning and showing up together and breathing together and practicing body to body together, that a tremendous intimacy developed between these two men, which is reflected in this story. And the part that moves me most about this story is actually Weka, someone, you know, I think that one adult, I cannot think of very many people to whom I would say, "Fix me." I think it's a very moving and vulnerable and open-hearted position to put oneself in, for one adult in particular to say that to another adult. I think it's a very, I think the vulnerability is tremendous. And the fact that Weka was able to go there, the fact that he lay himself bare in that way with Bodhidharma, leads me to think that that they had an incredibly deep relationship, and that there was a great deal of safety between this teacher and his student. That Bodhidharma created that and held that in the relationship, and that also Weka co-created that with Bodhidharma. So this ground of safety allows Weka to show up vulnerable, completely open, and present himself to the teacher, "Please help me. please fix this mind of mine, that is anguished. And I can also imagine in that moment, you know, that Bodhidharma could have responded in any number of ways. I think Bodhidharma might have said, you want me to what? You know, hey, you're the student. you're you know, that's your job. It's your job to fix your mind. It's your job to learn and to figure this out. You're your own teacher. I mean, I think there are any number of things Bodhidharma could have said in that moment. But what Bodhidharma actually said is, bring it on. I'll fix it. And I think it's just so moving to me that he completely met his student right where his student was. And again, witnessed in that the depth of his pain, that he would be willing to be so vulnerable. And I don't know, have you ever seen pictures of Bodhidharma? Is this a guy that you think, yeah, you know, I'm going to walk up and say, fix me? He looks like a pretty intense guy. So here's Weka showing up and taking this huge risk. And Bodhidharma, in this beautiful story, just meeting him there and saying, okay, I'll do it. And then, of course, you know, the net of the story is that Weka couldn't find what he could call mind any longer. And he reveals that to Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma says, dang, I'm good. I fixed it for you, see? But what actually happened? What did Bodhidharma actually do? And I think that in that moment, he mirrored to Weka what Weka himself could not see, which was his own effort, the fruit of his practice, a fruit of his practice. I think Bodhidharma mirrored to Weka what Weka was unable to see because because he had worked, he had been dedicated, he had been committed, he'd practiced for probably many years with Bodhidharma at this point. And I think, you know, as Kokyo said, I mean, I just love this, you know, he applied the medicine of the Dharma to his own mind and lost his mind. But he couldn't see that. He's still coming to his teacher saying, fix me. And Bodhidharma, it's the teacher who says, take another look. And then the student says, oh, well, I can't find it. So we put a lot of emphasis in Zen on the relationship between the student and the teacher. And we really see the teacher-student relationship as the primary vehicle of transmission of Dharma. So even though we spend hours and hours sitting on a cushion and engaging in forms and participating in Sangha and being with each other, ultimately in our practice, the relationship with the teacher is where the emphasis is. And I think this story shows us why. Because I think Sangha is a tremendous treasure. And I think we mirror for each other as well. And we teach each other as well. I have certainly been taught in Sangha so very, very much. But ultimately, it is the intimacy of person-to-person relationship, the teacher and the student, in which this mirroring can take place, in which enough safety can get created, enough trust for the student to reveal themselves and for the teacher to meet the student fully. And, you know, this is described in the story as, a Kensho experience for Weka. This is his, you know, awakening, his realization about his own mind, about mind, and about suffering, and what causes suffering, and what is the release of suffering, or what releases suffering. And so I think, I mean, when I look at the question, what did Bodhidharma do, I can summarize it with five words. He practiced. He tested. He taught. He witnessed. and he mirrored. And I think there we have it. In our earliest stories, a beautiful blueprint of what the teacher does. But we also, in this same story, have a beautiful example of what the student does. What did Weka do? What did he bring to the picture? First of all, he brought the depth of his dedication and his commitment to end his own suffering, his commitment to understand his own mind, to go deeper, to stay with his own suffering enough to get under it or in it fully in order to really grasp it or understand it. So we know from our study of the Four Noble Truths that the place of release is the place of grasping. So Weka was willing to go there. And he was willing to go there out loud with his teacher. So I think that is exactly what the student does. The student risks being seen in all sorts of ways, and being seen in the heart and mind and eyes of the teacher, being reflected in the teacher. And the reason I relate so much to this story, which just on the face of it seems to me a beautiful story about our practice and about Zen and about teachers and students, but the deeper piece for me personally is the emotional nature of Weka's pain. There are many ways to suffer. And emotional suffering in particular in our culture is not always skillfully received. I think in a way we are we don't really like to be around one another's emotional pain. There's not a lot of room for emotional pain because culturally, I think that in a sense it when I'm with someone who's highly emotional, sad or grieving, it affects me. It brings out my grief, my sadness. And so if I'm avoiding my own stuff, I'm not gonna, put myself in the near occasion of emotional pain. And so culturally, I think, we have very little room in this culture for physical pain, but I think we have even less room in this culture for emotional pain. I think we blame people for their emotional suffering. I think in Zen, we don't have a lot of language for emotional suffering. We think it's part of the story. We think the story should be dropped. And the very idea that emotional pain can be dropped at the door is as silly as the idea that physical pain can be dropped at the door. No one would say, leave your back pain at the door when you come in the Zendo or when you come to work. I hear this all the time from clients. Well, they ought to leave their problems at home. Well, if you want me to bring my body here, then I got to bring my mind and my heart. And I can't show up here as someone else in order to be comfortable with everyone in Sangha. If we want to be in Sangha together, then we want to be vast and broad and be able to be with one another. Be able to, show up when we are not at our best. And this is not easy. I would much rather hide at home when I feel the way I often feel. I would much rather do any number of other things than come and be visible to you. But we have to come here as we are. I can't have a different body because I would like to do full bows tonight with my recent knee fiasco. I can't drop my knee pain so that I can come in and do my full bows like I would like to. I can't do that. And in the same way, I can't drop emotional pain. to come and look different or be with you in a different way. And I would hope that, you know, we as a community can be with it, can hold one another in that. But I have to say that it's not easy. It's not easy. It takes a great deal of courage to show up when one feels like hiding, when one is overcome with grief or sadness or is in the throes of emotional pain, whatever it is. It's very difficult to come and be visible under those conditions. And I can imagine Weka's experience standing outside that hut thinking, God, I've just been rejected. And I need this. I need help here. That's why I asked for it. I need it. It's probably an act of bravery for him to ask. And now he's outside in the snow, standing, wondering what to do. So I can imagine that sometimes, you know, I mean, even for me, that's happened here, where I've stood outside and looked in and gone, oh, and gone home. So this is not easy to be the person showing up with that. And I want to acknowledge that for all of us who show up like that sometimes or who don't show up like because we feel like that. And I want to say, come here, bring it on. And then it's also difficult for the observer or the witness of this suffering. Emotional pain is hard to bear. It's hard to watch. This is why we, I think, you know, we resist it. I've heard people say, you know, well, her husband died a year ago. You know, she's still grieving. You know, get over it already. And I think that reflects a false view about emotional pain. Because emotional pain, I think, my experience is that it has to work its way through the body very slowly. That it is not droppable in the way that we think of it sometimes, or I hear it talked about in practice sometimes. So, and I think in Waco we see that. That he probably practiced for years bringing various versions of mind to Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma time and time again met him. Now, over these years, again, I can think, wow, you know, but you know, it's like, I've often thought, you know, it's like, you know, Bodhidharma could have said along that path, wow, you know, this is really hard, man, you know, it's just not changing, you know, you're not getting it, you know. Do you think if you started now that you could hike back to where you came from by winter? You know, I mean, I can imagine Bodhidharma, you know, like, dude, you know. But at the end of the day, that's not what Bodhidharma did. What Bodhidharma did was say, bring it on. Show it to me. And he mirrored in just almost as a perfectly clean mirror, as a perfect reflection, what his student was bringing to him over years. And I think that the depth of that and the commitment that Bodhidharma showed is really such a beautiful example to us of what we can do with each other, how we can be in practice. And so he had, you know, he had choices, and he chose to arrive day in and day out, and so did Weka. And the two of them created this beautiful story that we get to tell and have in our history. So I want to, if I could leave you with one thing this evening, I would just want to leave you with a feel for Weka, a feeling for him in your hearts. So I have, I unfortunately only have 10 of these because my printer died. But I can, you know, print more if people don't get one. I've asked Patrick to pass these out to you. So if you don't get one and you would like one, please just let me know and I can get one to you when I get my printer out of the printer hospital. But this is a brush painting of Weka that was probably done, you know, probably potentially, you know, centuries after his after this story was written. And when I saw this brush painting, my heart just, you know, met him. I felt a very personal connection with his pain in this painting. When you look at this painting, what is missing? There's nothing that isn't revealed there. There's nothing that isn't visible there. You can see here a man who is in pain, who is visibly, I have to think that this is how he showed up, that he showed up real. He didn't put on a happy face to go sit. That there's some lingering image of him that's revealed here. And I think it's very moving. So I offer you this partly, you know, I mean, I have to just say, you know, make me think of holy cards. You know, I mean, I'm Catholic on my parents' side. And, you know, holy cards are a big thing. And so that's what I think of with these. But they're just images of honorable beings. And so that's how I see this. There is a quote by Weka, a famous quote by him on the back of the picture. But the picture is what I really want you to have. And I want it in your hearts, because to me, this is he has given us such a gift to be so revealing of himself. And I know how hard that is, because it's something I struggle with and something I work with every day. When I get up in the morning and I go to my work, or I come here, wherever I go, I'm always sort of where I feel like I'm right there with him. And many times in my world, in contemporary America, you know, I put on my happy face and I go do my work. But the people with whom I can reveal myself give me such a great gift. And I think that's something we have, that we can freely offer one another. So that's what I think is so deep, the yearning of Weka to understand his suffering, so much so that he would make a tremendous sacrifice for that, whatever it may have been. And the courage and depth of his teacher, who showed up real, who showed up empty, and who met him all along the way. So I want just to end by expressing my deep gratitude to these two men, and also to the people who captured this beautiful story so that we could have it today to talk about. Thank you. Well, I think the first is that he practiced. I think teachers practice. They sit, you know. So I think he sat. He tested Weka. And he taught. He witnessed his suffering and his strength. And he mirrored his realization to him. 10-5. Okay. I'm bad at math, so.
And in there, what do you think he gave, if anything?
I think he gave himself completely. Any questions? Any other questions? Dave?
It's such a beautiful story, and thank you for sharing it and stepping forward yourself. I'm stuck on the thing about the R. It's just the, I can't like quite get this out of my mind, you know? And it kind of immediately, this is probably my doubting Thomas, doubting Dana mind about this, but it seems like that's a pretty harsh test. And so am I just being too like stuck and literal on this, or I mean, I noticed you said we don't really know exactly what happened. And it doesn't matter. So maybe you could just say that for me again. I'm still stuck on this thing about, you know, he's out in the snow for what appears to be 6 months. You know, spring is coming up, there's flowers, and he whacks off his arm and then he gives it to him. And that seems a high price to me.
No, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I think it's kind of a stopper, that story, I know. And I, you know, I think that it's not so important about the arm. I think what's important is the obvious desperation that Weka felt. The depth of his aspiration, but to understand his own suffering, to penetrate his own suffering, but also, I mean, I just can't help but see it as a desperate act. What's interesting to me in your question is that Bodhidharma didn't say, hey, go cut off your arm and that'll show me. Bodhidharma just said no. Weka decided to cut off the arm. So I think sometimes, you know, as students, you know, maybe all it would have taken was like, hey, hang out there overnight and come back in and ask me and I'll say yes, you know. But he stood out there for who knows how long, or stayed out there for who knows how long, trying to figure out what to do. I mean, that to me is just totally a part of his practice with Bodhidharma, that he had to struggle with what does this guy want? What will it take to prove it to him? And then he, you know, the story says he cut off his arm. Undoubtedly, you know, he did something to demonstrate the depth of his commitment. I think it makes a great story, a very compelling story. It's memorable, but not, you know, clearly he did something that showed Bodhidharma that he meant business, and he really, really was so committed that he would put himself through the crucible of zazen and of study up close with a teacher, even in the midst of his emotional suffering or his mental anguish. And that, to me, is the important part of that aspect of the story. Thank you. And I, by the way, feel like I've cut off, you know, all sorts of body parts to try to, you know, to be, I mean, in figuratively speaking, in terms of the, just, you know, what it kind of takes to show up with that amount of pain that is so hard to be with and so hard to witness, knowing that my presence will not be easy to witness for other people, that my presence will cause pain for other people or difficulty for other people in itself. It makes it, you know, hard to show up and be real. And it is, it can feel not unlike sort of sacrificing something that big. You know, clearly I haven't yet. Yes.
And maybe the kind of modern thing would be that you could be in some emotional pain, but, you know, we kind of, we bring this own ourselves.
Yeah.
Because I know I do this too.
Yeah.
Sit upright without aiding somewhere.
Yeah. Without leaning. Without leaning. Thank you. I think it's one thing to, I keep doing this to you, Dan, but I think, you know, I think it's one thing to show up, with emotional pain for, you know, maybe 6 months or something, you know, but 5 years, 10 years, 15 years into a relationship. I mean, I've had, friends, I have a 30-year friend who just last year said to me, Beata, you know, this is hard to bear. This has looked similar for 30 years. You know, where's, you know, and she's with me. I mean, she was at my ordination. I mean, she's with me, but she's expressing that as the witness of that pain, it's very difficult to bear for a long time. And I'm, it's difficult for me to bear. And I'm very aware also that it's difficult for others to bear. And I'm sad about that. But again, if I'm going to get up in the morning and come here, I have to come as I am. And we all have to come as we are. So let's be big and work to include even that that's so hard and that gets old, you know, and difficult to see again and again. So, Chuck, thank you for moving me on.
Since we've known you, which has not been a long time, maybe 3 years or a little more, you have always had that saying, come as you are, and you just said it again. And I have to tell you, you are always so moving to me to listen to your story, to witness your struggle. And I appreciate you so much. And it seems like every time I hear you speak, I appreciate you more. And so that saying, come as you are, is so inviting. It is so broad and all-encompassing. And it has such simplicity at the same time. So I just wanted to express to you that there's something about the way you do that that is so heartfelt and so direct and yet has such simplicity to it. And we've really enjoyed being around you in a variety of ways, both with the board and sitting together and hearing you speak, sitting down to eat, you know, in all these different ways. It's just been such a privilege to have your company. And sharing the story, I know that you've studied Bodhidharma a great deal, and as raw as that story is, and I agree with you, it doesn't matter if the arm went or not. What it illustrates so terrifically is anguish. The suffering of this person, it illustrates that so perfectly. Because it's so extreme.
Yeah, exactly.
That it makes your mind go to that suffering and appreciate the persistence of a person that wants help, that wants to find a way. So it's really a wonderful story to share. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chuck, and feelings are mutual. Thank you.
Kathy. How do you work with the dilemma that we have to come as we are? We have no alternative. And not only that, but that, just as you've expressed, the power and the beauty of just this. And when in the student-teacher dynamic, whether it be a person who's a teacher or a friend or circumstances, are calling you to be different, or challenging you to be different, or criticizing what you're making your best effort. And you're, you know, so there's obviously, there's the opportunity for one of your five, the testing, there's the opportunity there. But as we know, I mean, we've talked about this a lot over the years, there's that fine line. And I know you have really practiced with that. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to say anything in this context about how you're practicing with that. Because experiencing you giving this talk tonight, I feel deeply how you are working with it in a way that feels healthy.
Well, I mean, this is a very deep question, and I don't want to be glib, and so it might be something we want to talk about, you know, later as well. But at this moment, what I would say is two things. One is, you know, I rely on my vow, and my vow is to be authentic, and recognizing that it isn't always comfortable for others, and doing what I can to keep that in mind, and to give other people permission to be however they need to be, you know, to come as they are, even if how they are is they can't be around me because I'm in so much pain. I mean, that's part of the vow, to be authentic, is to also, you know, not, I mean, just to try to be aware of the impact of the conditions of my life on other people. So that's one piece. The other piece is that when I was ordained, I took a vow to be visible in Sangha. I mean, you know, you put on this giant post-it note called a robe, and, you know, you're visible. And I knew that. And I said, okay, I'm gonna do that. Because I want other people to look at me and say, if she can do it, I can do it. And so it actually extended the vow of authenticity into being into a vow to actually be willing to show my pain. Because I think that's a gift. And I feel it as a gift when other people do it, because it gives me permission. And that's the kind of Sangha I want to be part of. A Sangha that says, what will it take for you to be here with us? Because whatever it takes, we want to meet it. Because we're that big. We can do that. So bring it on, and we'll meet you. That's the kind of Sangha I want to be part of. So therefore, I have to be willing. And that's how I work. That's one sort of set of ways that I work with it. Thank you. I think it's probably time to end, isn't it?
A few more minutes.
Okay.
However,
yes. Thank you, Kathy. Anything else? Kathy has to leave. She has an appointment to go to. Kathy and Shoho have to go. So. Thank you.
I'm just an emotional roller coaster, and I've been feeling like I don't want to show myself in public in front of people that I know, because I'm not going to act like the person that they think I am.
Yeah.
And that just adds to my pain about how I feel. So
I wasn't even sure. I know that we're here to practice acceptance of things as they are, being with things as they are, and this presents a tremendous challenge for me, but I didn't know if we were here to be present for things as they are with each other, rather than coming up with in our own personal lives. And so now I understand that, and I think I can be more authentic here in the Sangha.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that.
We were talking about how sometimes emotional pain takes a long time and it takes its own time. And, have you found any ways to work with that? Like, I've heard the practice and tried the practice of fully grieving, like a loss, like if it's emotional pain or a loss, to fully, in order to let it go, really feel it. And the very avoidance of it continues it.
Right.
But I don't know if there's if that practice or others help you with that process.
I think that's the core of it. Is being willing to be fully in it. This is the edge of where I am, is that I'm no longer convinced. A month ago, I thought, oh yeah, you know, I can release the grief or the suffering or what. And I've come to a different place. I don't think I release anything. I think it releases. And perhaps my presence with it, you know, presence over time allows it to release. But I'm not sure that it's as active a process as it sounds to say, go into it and then you can let it go. I think it lets go in its time. And my job is to just persist and, you know, cut off my arm and you know, keep showing up in it and being willing to be in it fully, and not worrying about whether I can let it go or whether it's letting go, or, you know, it just will let go or not, and I just have to show up, you know, again and again. And so that's kind of where I am with that. There are many, many practices that I use with. I use mantra. I use loving kindness. Sayings to. I offer my own heart comfort with loving kindness to sustain me. I sit. You know, I talk with other people. I call my sangha. I need help. I need to talk to someone. I lean on people. I'm not always upright in a sort of ideal way. I lean. I try to be conscious when I'm leaning so that my leaning is upright, but it's still leaning. I have a therapist. I see my therapist. I think that's important. I think sometimes, you know, I know this is sort of like anti-practice, but the fact is sometimes, you know, we need an expert to help us navigate some of these waters. And I'm willing to just say, yes, I do that. And it's been extremely valuable. It's been a part of my practice to do that. So all of those things and many, many other practices. A teacher early on, my very first teacher taught me loving kindness, taught me a set of loving kindness phrases that really seemed to help me. So I try to pay attention to what raises my energy, and I try to do more of that, and to try to pay attention to what, you know, lowers my energy and do less of that. But at the end of the day, you know, it's just about being exactly as authentic as I can be to what's going on, to the conditions of my life and the conditions around me, and meet that. And that's without any particular goal or outcome in mind, but just to keep doing that.
wonder if there's some relationship between the showing up presently for our experience and the not being able to find the painful mind.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
It seems like that's the apex of that story.
Mm-hmm. It's, not being able to find it.
Emotional pain
mm-hmm.
at its core.
Right.
Not being able to find it. And there's something about the showing up
mm-hmm.
in Huayca's case that made it possible for
yes.
him to not find it.
That's right. And who knows how long that went on. And also, who knows, I mean, I think we have in the story a moment in time where he dropped, that dropped for him. The next moment is unknown. You know, I just can't say what the next moment was for Huayca. But I do can say that in my own experience, the moment after that connection is made is different, even though it's suffering. There is still emotional pain in the next moment, but it is transformed for that moment having happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder in the story too about after his transformation, how did he feel about having cut off his arm?
Yeah, I think that too. Yeah, it's like, oh, that was a little permanent solution there.
That wasn't so necessary.
Yeah.
Well, that was necessary.
That's what it took.
In that moment. And,
yeah.
Now
yeah.
I'm just practicing in the moment.
Yeah. And I'm willing to do that.
That's okay.
Yeah. I'm willing to do that. And mind you, Huayca lived to be 105. He was probably in his early 30s when he met Bodhidharma, maybe his late 20s, early 30s. He wasn't an adolescent. He was, you know, older by their standards. But he lived to be 105 and taught, you know, in China for the rest of his life. Single-armedly, apparently. So he continued. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you all very much. We can continue our conversation over tea. Thank you.